action. In his opinion, the greatest thing he had going for him, besides that he was still alive, was that he wasn't bound even more restrictively. Despite the pain, he could move if he really wanted to. And he did. He realized that he didn't need his arms, legs, or wrists to move. If he used only his pelvis and his chest, he could shuffle in a two-step inchworm process.
First, lift my chest, and slide it to the right, and then lift my pelvis, and follow.
It took Andre almost 3 hours to cross the basement floor and get to the washer and dryer area on the other side of the room. It had been necessary to stop repeatedly to catch his breath. The exertion increased his respiration, which was already impaired by the gag and the strong odor of shoe polish that filled his nostrils whenever he tried to breathe deeply. When he reached the laundry area, he rolled onto his side so that the cord on his wrists and ankles faced the metal leg of an old wash basin between the washer and dryer. As he couldn't stand upright, this was his only chance. He began rocking back and forth, dragging the laundry cord across the leg of the wash basin. The process was agonizingly slow. A warm, sticky, wet feeling began to spread across his hands, and he knew that he was bleeding, but he pressed on. There was no telling when the senator would return to finish the job, and therefore nothing mattered but getting free. An animal instinct took over, and Andre rocked harder, sawing his wrists and ankles against the metal. All control he had over his mind had vanished. He kept thinking about wolves caught in traps, who chew their own legs off to escape as he swung his body and sawed faster. Finally, there was a muffled snap, and the tension on his wrists and ankles let up ever so slightly. The cord was fraying. He closed his eyes to try to shut out the pain. He resumed the fevered pitch of his rocking while he applied outward pressure on the cord from his hands and feet. Another snap. He was almost there. Andre rocked his body for all he was worth and was greeted finally with the sweet sensation of release. The cord ripped the rest of the way away. His feet fell backward and his arms went limp at his sides. Though he knew he needed to work on getting more circulation to his extremities, he just lay on the floor and wept for several minutes, allowing exhaustion to sweep through him. The only movement he made was to remove the gag. As he spat it out, he saw that Snyder had indeed used a shoeshine rag. He seethed with anger, but was too tired to allow it to overtake him. He had won, at least so far. And he took his time savoring the small victory as he lay motionless on the floor. After giving himself a short rest, Andre gathered enough momentum for the painful roll onto his back. He held his wrists in front of his face and examined the bleeding from the gashes in his raw, burned skin. Contracting his stomach muscles, he leaned upward and looked down at his ankles, which were not much better. The left side of his body looked as if he had been dragged down 3 miles of a highway covered in loose gravel and broken glass. It was all painful, but he would live.
What was he saying? He wasn't out of harm's way yet.
Okay, Mr. Travolta, he said to himself. If the key words here are staying alive, then we need to get you out of here.
Andre continued to crunch upward until he was in a sitting position. He rolled his shoulders back and forth and also twisted his ankles in painful circles, helping to improve the blood flow. Stripping off the remaining cord that was clinging to him, he blessed the lightness of being Yoga Center for the flexibility he now enjoyed and made a mental note to make a donation when and if he was completely out of this situation. Andre pulled himself to a standing position. Twisting the faucet handle, he waited for the wash basin's rusty brown water to turn clear before submerging his wrists in the cascade. The water burned at first, and then felt numbingly sweet. As much as he wanted to stand and let the water run over his wrists for hours, he knew he had to get moving. As in many of Georgetown's ritzier townhomes, a laundry chute fed from the top floor of the building, where the bedrooms were, down into the basement. Not far from the washer and dryer, Andre saw the laundry basket used to catch whatever came down. Mingled with the senator's clothes were the brown corduroys and turtleneck sweater he had shot down the chute just yesterday. He rummaged further and found a pair of dirty sweat socks and began to get dressed. As he finished pulling on his socks, he looked down at a bloodied piece of cord. Andre wasn't stupid. He knew if he brought any charges against the senator, it would be his word against Snyder's. For a good part of the time that he had lain naked, cold, and scared on the moldy concrete floor, he had wondered who would ever believe his story. Knowing the senator would do everything in his power to stop it from becoming public, Andre needed some sort of proof that he had been there. He looked down at the piece of bloody cord again and kicked it as hard as he could under the dryer. He could no longer control the urge to run, and he moved quickly toward the back of the basement, where a small utility door led up a short flight of steps to the garden. Not wanting to even attempt to use the front door, for fear of bumping into Snyder, Andre rushed to the garden door. He grabbed the cold metal handle and turned. Locked. He tried again, but no luck. The door was deadbolted with a lock that needed a key from either side. The glass was no better, as it was covered with a thick wire security mesh. A wave of nausea began to grow in the pit of his stomach. Andre fought to keep it down. Think. There has got to be a way. He knew that all of the windows in the basement were covered with the exact same security mesh. It seemed hopeless. Looking up, as if imploring heaven for some sort of aid, he saw his salvation. Above the right-hand corner of the doorframe was a rusted nail with a key hanging from it. Please let this be the one. Andre took down the key and slid it into the lock, his hand trembling. It fit. But as he turned the key to the left, it wouldn't budge. The same thing happened when he turned it to the right. Shit, it's the wrong key. Taking a deep breath, he told himself to calm down. The senator could arrive home at any moment. Andre needed to keep his wits about him. He tried the key again, harder.
Careful, don't break it.
Nothing. Remembering his own trouble with the fifth-generation key for the condo he and Mitch had shared, Andre applied a little English. He pulled slightly as he twisted. Joyous relief flooded his body as the key finally turned all of the way, drawing back the deadbolt and releasing the door. The moist smell of clean outside air flowed into his nose and mouth. A steady rain was falling, and a large puddle sat at the base of the concrete steps. While trying to work the lock, he had noticed a set of gardening tools off to his right, including a pair of green Wellington boots. By the looks of them, they were Snyder's. Andre had bigger feet, but didn't think twice as he grabbed a pair of shears and cut the toes off each boot. He quickly pulled them on and crept cautiously from the basement. The garden was cold, and the night air was heavy with the mist of the steadily falling shower. He still had no idea what time it was, and didn't care. Snyder obviously thought he could come back and finish him at any point. He had no reason to suspect Andre would have been able to get away. Creeping slowly, using the large trees for cover, he made his way to the end of the garden. The stone rococo fountain gave him enough of a foothold to climb up to the top of the wall. As he pushed with his left leg to get the final thrust he needed, a stone cherub's head dislodged and clattered down with a roaring splash into the pool of water below. It made no difference. Andre Martin landed effortlessly in the neighbor's yard and was off like a shot, the knowledge of what the senator would do to him if he caught up, pushing him forward. 35. Director Jameson saved his admonishments for the ride home, and Scott took each one of them without arguing. Had he been given a chance to get a word in edgewise, he might have admitted that some of his actions had surprised even him. But as it stood, he rode along in the director's limousine in silence. As they pulled up to Harvath's apartment building, it was already after 10 o'clock, and Director Jameson ordered him to be at the Treasury building the next morning for a full debriefing in the presence of the secretary. Jameson also warned him that the secretary of the Treasury was not a man to be fooled around with, and that Harvath had better be on his best behavior. Thanking the director, Scott closed the door of the limo, turned the collar of his trench coat up against the rain, and didn't bother to open his umbrella for the short run up the pavement to the front entrance. He ignored his mailbox and took the stairs slowly, his headache not having abated much in the past several hours. At his door, he checked that the brown hair was exactly where he had left it. It was. He took it down, removed the keys from his pocket, and let himself in. The apartment looked exactly the same. Why he expected it to be any different, he didn't know. Sometimes, he mused about how nice it would be to have someone waiting on the other side of the door when he came home, someone friendly. His lifestyle had never been conducive to long-term relationships. In the SEALs, he could be mobilized in a moment's notice and be gone for months at a time without any warning. He had watched a lot of special operations guys go through painful and messy divorces. The simplest answer for Scott was to just avoid getting too serious with anyone. Casual relationships were a lot easier, and it had never been tough finding women who wanted to be with him, temporarily. Several women in Scott's life had liked him enough to press him on committing to a deeper relationship. None of them ever understood why he soon thereafter broke things off, or, more often, just faded away. As difficult as it was for him, he believed that was easier in the long run. While his hectic life had calmed down a lot since retasking to the Secret Service, it was still unpredictable, and after all, old habits, especially those of the heart, really did die hard. Scott continued to reflect on bachelorhood as he hung his trench coat and took off his suit. Putting on a dark blue sweatsuit with the word Navy written in yellow across the chest and on the upper left thigh, he decided a little light exercise might do him some good. He put on a pair of Nikes, exited his apartment, and headed downstairs. With the building's history of less than stellar tenants and more than one break-in, the landlady was extremely glad to have Secret Service agent Scott Harvath living in one of her apartments. He had not needed to ask her twice about using a small corner of the relatively empty basement as a place to set up his exercise equipment. The workout was slow-going. Harvath spent the first 20 minutes doing some light stretching. The exercises allowed him to assess the damage that had been done to his body and how well he was healing. While he was still tremendously sore, he knew that a lot of the stiffness he felt could be relieved by working out. He wasn't foolish enough to believe that he could jump right back into his routine, so he knocked down the normal amounts he lifted to 60%. He remembered Dr. Helzebeck's warnings not to exacerbate his symptoms through stress or physical exertion, so he made sure not to push things too hard. His muscles burned. The familiar sensation felt good and helped take his mind off of his headache, both the one between his ears and the one that came between paychecks, his job. Harvath finished his workout with 45 minutes on the treadmill. The mindless repetition of jogging on the inclined belt allowed him to be lost in exercise-induced euphoria for just a little while longer. Returning to his apartment, he noticed the new call light blinking on his caller ID box. As he crossed the living room to pick up his cordless phone, it began to ring.
"Harvath," he answered.
"Scott, thank God you're finally home. I've been trying to get a hold of you for over an hour," said an agitated female voice.
"Natalie, is that you?" asked Scott.
Natalie Sperando was assistant to the social secretary of the White House and coordinated most of President Rutledge's social appearances. While Secret Service guidelines strictly forbade service personnel from dating any executive staff, especially when assigned to White House duty, it never said anything about not being friends with them, and Scott and Natalie had become good ones during his time there.
"Yes, it's me. Scott, I need your help," she said.
"What kind of help?
You sound upset. Are you okay?" "I can't go into it over the phone. I need you to meet me."
"It sounds serious."
"Very."
"All right, I just finished working out. Let me grab a shower and—"
"I need to meet you now. Can you take the shower later?" asked Natalie.
"Nat, do you want to give me an idea what this is all about?"
"I can't. Not over the phone."
"Are you in some sort of trouble?"
"Kind of. It involves a friend of my brother's. Please, Scott, can you just come meet me?"
"Sure. I'll bag the shower. Tell me where you are."
Natalie gave Scott the name and address, telling him to hurry. He got out of his sweats and pulled on a pair of jeans and a denim shirt. He glanced at his holstered SIG next to the bed and realized it would mean either another layer of clothing or he would have to keep his jacket on all night to conceal it. He decided against it. He wouldn't need a gun where he was going. Harvath had the cabbie drop him at the DuPont Circle metro stop. From there, he walked down Massachusetts Avenue towards Scott Circle. He turned onto 17th Street and walked to an upscale pub known as JR's. JR's catered to a gay clientele that liked to refer to themselves as guppies or gay urban professionals. With its long varnished bar and stained glass windows, had it not been for the lack of women, JR's would have looked like any other DC watering hole. As Scott made his way through the patrons enjoying the Tuesday $5 all-you-can-drink special, he finally found Natalie in the back corner with a man he didn't recognize.
"Oh, Scott, I'm so glad you're here," said Natalie, as she stood to give him a hug. "Anything for you, Nat. You know that, but can you tell me what I'm doing sitting in a bar at..."
He paused to look at his watch.
"At 12 o'clock on a Tuesday night?"
"It's all my fault, I'm afraid. At least to a certain degree," said the man who was sitting at the table with Natalie.
He looked pale and drawn. Scott noticed when he offered his hand that his wrist was crudely bandaged and some blood showed through. Scott took the man's hand.
"It's nice to meet you, Mr.—"
The man threw a tentative glance toward Natalie, who nodded her head that everything was okay.
"Martin. My name is Andre Martin. We met about a month ago when I was visiting the White House to see Natalie. It's okay, though. You must meet a lot of people in your job."
"You'll forgive me. I'm normally good with faces. What can I do for you?"
Before he could answer, a waiter who had been hovering close by came over to take their drink orders. Andre ordered himself another bourbon. Natalie declined, her wine glass still half full, and Scott ordered a Heineken. When the waiter left, Andre lifted his glass and finished the small bit of brownish gold liquid that remained. His hand shook.
"Okay, Nat, you said this was important and had something to do with a friend of your brother's," said Scott.
"It is, and it does. Andre is one of Steven's friends. He..."
Andre cleared his throat.
"Natalie, why don't I just jump in here and explain? Agent Harvath, are you familiar with the murder of Senator David Snyder's aide, Mitchell Conti, that happened almost a year ago?"
"Yeah, I think so. A drive-by, wasn't it? As I remember, the kid was pretty well liked on the Hill."
"He was," said Andre. "The papers billed it as a bad case of wrong place, wrong time, but I never bought that."
"Why not?"
asked Scott.
"Because," continued Andre, "they were never able to find the shooter and who the intended victim or victims were."
"Mr. Martin, I hate to say it, but unfortunately the DC police are only human, and they have their hands full. There are lots of homicides that go unsolved every year. It's not that unusual."
"No? Well, what if I told you that Mitchell Conti was also Senator Snyder's lover?"
Scott couldn't believe his ears. He looked at Natalie, who nodded her head.
"Mr. Martin, supposing this was true, how would you be in a position to come across this piece of information? And while we're at it, what does it have to do with the drive-by, and how in any way does this have anything even remotely to do with me?"
"Agent Harvath, if you'll give me a second, I'll explain."
Scott sat back in his chair and was quiet as the waiter brought their drinks. Once he was gone, Andre began again. "I know these things because Mitchell Conti and I were lovers. We lived together. I left him because of his relationship with Senator Snyder." Scott interrupted.
"But I know of at least 5 women over the last 2 years that the senator is reported to have been seeing. He's known in the Beltway as quite a ladies' man."
"So is Mitch, but appearances can be deceiving. Besides, being bisexual doesn't make someone any less of a man, nor any less attractive to women."
Scott was going to have to take Andre's word on that one. He sipped his beer and waited for him to continue. After a shaky sip from his new drink and a look around to make sure they weren't being overheard, Andre went on to tell Scott the details of Mitch's involvement with Snyder and the possible blackmail. It's all a very interesting story, Mr. Martin, and I'm sorry for your loss, but I still don't see what...
What you don't see, Agent Harbath, is that shortly thereafter Mitch was killed in the supposed drive-by shooting. I was convinced that Mitch's death was no accident, and the police weren't getting anywhere. So, I decided to look into matters myself.
Wonderful. This guy's a regular Dick Tracy, thought Harbath.
I did all the research I could on Senator Snyder, and being familiar with many of his predilections via Mitch, I arranged for the two of us to meet. Of course, I made it look like it was quite by chance, but little by little, I began to win his confidence, and we began seeing each other.
Okay, Mr. Martin, I'm going to stop you right there. I have many gay friends. I don't want you to think for one second that this is a problem I have with someone else's lifestyle, because it isn't. But this is just a little too wild for my taste. And as far as you have explained, there's no way in the world this could have anything at all to do with me.
But if you would let me finish.
Andre, I'm going to save you the time, and please excuse me for using your first name.
Not at all. It's okay.
Good. Listen, I like you. You seem like a nice guy. A smart guy. If you have some concrete evidence that Senator Snyder was involved directly or indirectly with Mr. Conti's death, I suggest you take it straight to the D.C. District Attorney's office. But I warn you, what do you do for a living?
I'm an attorney.
Well then, I don't need to warn you of the downside if what you know or what you think you know gets back to Senator Snyder. He is a very powerful man and has a lot of friends. He could make a lot of trouble for you.
But, Agent Harbath, what I have to tell you isn't about Mitch's death. It's about the president's disappearance.
Natalie spoke up, but he almost didn't hear her.
See, Scott? This is the reason I called you.
Scott's attitude went from boredom and condescension to rapt interest in an instant. If you have any information whatsoever about the president's kidnapping, I suggest you spill it right now.
36.
For the 100th time in the last hour, Scott glanced warily around the room to make sure they were not being overheard. Andre Martin's story was absolutely incredible. Harbath now understood why Nat had brought Andre to him. Where else could the poor guy go? If what he was saying was true, no one would have believed him, and if Snyder wasn't out looking for him already, he was going to be very soon. The implications of what Andre was saying were staggering. Harbath probed for more details, needing to paint the most accurate picture possible.
So based on all of this, you think the senator was somehow involved in the president's kidnapping?
Exactly.
I don't know, Andre. There's no question after what he did to you that the guy is one sick puppy. But you really think he was going to kill you for what you overheard? I mean, from what you tell me, you don't exactly have a smoking gun, said Harbath.
Exactly again. I didn't see or hear anything that would ever stand up in court, but he still wanted me dead.
Are you positive he wanted to kill you and not just scare you?
Scott, said Andre, having dropped the formality of calling him Agent Harbath over half an hour ago.
I'm a lawyer, and lawyers believe that what is not said is just as important as what is.
Snyder had no idea what I heard or didn't hear. All he knew was what I was saying or not saying.
I don't follow you.
You were right in part that he was trying to scare me. He scared the shit out of me, and he left me in the basement to do some very hard thinking. He planned to come back, and when he did, he would want answers. He would want to hear what I hadn't been saying. You follow me now?
Yeah, I do. But this is the part of your story that scares me the most, said Scott. What you are alleging is pretty serious, and from the look and the sound of it, you can back it up. If nothing else, it would be extremely embarrassing for the senator.
You're right. I don't think you were ever meant to walk out of that house alive again.
So you're convinced?
Enough to know that Natalie did the right thing in calling me.
I knew you would help us, said Natalie.
Us? As in both of you? No way, Nat. You need to let me help Andre alone while you stay as far away as possible. This could be extremely dangerous.
Listen, Scott, I didn't call you up so you could sweep in here and start giving orders. Andre called me because he didn't know who else to turn to.
Now that you've heard his story, you see why he couldn't go to the police.
Yeah, but I'm here now, and we can help him, protect him.
Who's we?
The Secret Service?
From what I hear around the White House, you guys have so many leaks, Vice President Marshfield is even talking about suspending Secret Service protection and using FBI bodyguards.
Scott's blood pressure began to rise.
First of all, Vice President Marshfield doesn't know his ass from a hole in the ground. The Secret Service is charged with his protection, as well as the safety and security of the White House and all those within it. We're there to stay. You won't be seeing any FBI protective details, that I can assure you. As far as any leaks are concerned, we've yet to nail that down, but there isn't any reason the service can't put Andre into protective custody until we get to the bottom of this. It's just going to take a little time.
Time?
But I thought you said I was in danger, said Andre.
I believe you are, but it's going to take me a couple of hours to set everything up and bring you in. While I do that, we need to get you someplace safe.
He can come back to my apartment, said Natalie.
Nat, I told you this could be dangerous, and I don't want you involved. You did the right thing, and now I want you to walk away.
And I told you, Scott, that I'm staying right here with Andre. He's been extremely kind to my brother over the years, and I'm not going to repay that kindness by ditching him in his hour of need.
Scott knew when he was licked.
Okay, have it your way, but I don't want you going home.
Why not?
Because if Snyder's out looking for Andre, and he knows the connection between you two, he might go to your apartment. How much cash do you have?
About $100, I think. I hit the cash machine after work.
Harvath reached into his pocket and peeled off $200 bills.
Now you've got $300.
I want you to get in a cab and head for Alexandria. Go to the Radisson Old Town on Fairfax and pay cash for a room for one night. Tell them you're AAA members, but your purse and wallet were stolen and you have no ID on you. That should knock the rate in half and stop them from asking any questions. Register under the name Cashman. Once you get inside, don't call anyone. I'll call you. You got it?
I still think going to my place is okay.
Nat, you asked me for a favor, and now I'm asking you for one. Go there and stay put.
Okay, we'll do it. But make sure you hurry up.
I'll get to you as soon as I can. Again, I don't think you're in any immediate danger. We just need to be sure.
Harvath extended his hand toward Andre.
We'll get to the bottom of this. Don't worry.
I hope so, said Andre, who stood and shook his hand.
Natalie was putting on her coat.
You know, Scott, you asked me if there was anything else that seemed odd about the senator's behavior recently.
Yes.
There was one other thing I forgot to mention. But it might not mean anything.
What was it?
Well, it was just another inconsistency in one of Snyder's stories, but a pretty major one, I thought.
Scott raised his eyebrows as if to say, keep going.
About a month ago, the senator took off on an unplanned trip. We had plans, and he canceled on me. He brought me back a bottle of dessert wine. He said it was a favorite of Napoleon or Josephine or something, but it didn't make sense. The whole thing bothered me for a couple of reasons.
Why?
Well, he said he was called away on a World Bank Economic Development Conference.
So?
Well, I specialize in international finance, and it wasn't difficult to find out that there were no World Bank functions at that time.
Maybe he told you the wrong thing, or you misunderstood.
I don't misunderstand things that easily.
Well, you said it bothered you for a couple of reasons. What's the other?
He told me he'd been in France for the conference, but there was a half-stripped Swiss Railways checked luggage sticker on his suitcase.
That could have been from a previous trip.
I thought so, too, until I showed the bottle of wine to a friend of mine. He's kind of a wine snob, and I wanted to impress him. I'd never had a dessert wine from South Africa before.
Andre, listen, you both need to get going.
Just let me finish. This friend of mine had heard of the wine. It has a very high sugar content, and its import is banned in the EU.
So,
France is part of the European Union. The senator couldn't have possibly found this in some little French wine shop, like he said.
I'm sorry, Andre, I still don't get it.
Switzerland is not part of the EU, and they do allow this particular wine to be imported, regardless of its sugar and alcohol levels.
So, What was he doing in Switzerland that was such a big secret?
Andre, it might be something, and it might not. I'll look into it. Now, both of you, get going.
What about Stargazer? Prompted Natalie. You said the whole thing wouldn't work without Stargazer.
Oh yeah, I forgot that one.
Who is Stargazer? Asked Scott.
I've got no idea.
I overheard the senator mention that whatever he was doing wouldn't work without Stargazer. Does that make any sense to you?
Not much of any of this makes sense. Now, seriously, you have to get going.
Harvath pushed the two toward the door and waited 5 minutes. He left 2 20s on the table and exited JR's through the back. A strange yet all too familiar feeling began to creep over him in the murky DC night. As he turned up the collar on his trench coat once again, he wished he'd brought his pistol. 37.
Despite the confidence he had shown upon saying goodbye and packing Natalie and Andre off to the Radisson, Harvath had no idea what his next move was going to be. His credibility wasn't exactly first rate in Washington these days, and he knew he would have to be very careful about whom he shared his newfound knowledge with. What he had was explosive and could do an incredible amount of damage whether it was true or not. The mere suggestion that a senator, possibly two, might have been involved with the kidnapping of the President of the United States was almost inconceivable. Scott normally did his best thinking on his feet, so when he left JR's, he walked, ignoring the light but steady rain that fell. He moved south on 17th Street, passing Farragut Square, and turned left when he reached H Street. He walked along Lafayette Square until he reached 15th, sorting and resorting everything he had heard. He spun the name Stargazer around and around, trying to get a handle on it. Who or what was Stargazer? And what did the name have to do with what Senator Snyder was up to? At 15th, without giving it any thought, he automatically turned right. A block and a half later, he was standing in front of the Treasury building. In less than 8 hours, he was supposed to be back at this exact site for a detailed debriefing with Director Jameson and the Secretary of the Treasury, Paul Feigin. He wondered if once they'd extracted from him everything they wanted, they would terminate him on the spot. Scott remembered what he had told himself only yesterday, though it seemed like a lifetime ago. If he was going to have any hope of keeping his career intact, he would need to be part of something that helped crack the case. That something might have fallen right into his lap, thanks to Natalie Sperando. Or so he hoped. If no one believed Andre's story, or if it couldn't be verified, Scott was probably as good as washed up. It would look as if he were grasping at straws, doing anything he could to save himself, no matter how ridiculous it was, and no matter whose name he dragged through the mud. He had to be very careful how he handled things. But even if Andre turned out to be a dead end, Harvath had taken an oath to protect the president, and he had made a promise to Sam Harper. Those commitments would not disappear, no matter how tough things got. He knew he had to bring this information into the open, and he now knew exactly whom he could count on for help. Cutting up New York Avenue, Harvath hailed a cab in front of the Presbyterian Church and gave the driver an address in Arlington, Virginia. The chances that the man he was going to see would still be awake were pretty slim, but he was the only person who could help Scott, and potentially, the president. The front porch lights were out when Scott climbed the stairs, and he took that as a bad sign. He knew that the minute he rang the bell, not only would he wake the man inside, but the man would be pretty upset. William Shaw had a very short fuse. The director of the Secret Service operations for the White House, and Scott's boss, hadn't come by his call sign of Fury for nothing. Scott steeled himself and reached for the glowing orange button that seemed to hover over the house's brick facade. After several seconds, lights began turning on within the house, and eventually an exterior overhead light came on, pinning Harvath against the darkness.
"Who the hell is it?" came a gruff voice from inside.
"It's Harvath, Bill. Open up."
From inside, Scott heard a chain slide back, followed by several deadbolts. Finally, the door opened, and there stood a sleepy William Shaw. He had a face of unshaved whiskers, bedhead, and one hand in the pocket of his terry cloth robe, probably curled around his Sig Sauer semi-automatic.
"Harvath, this had better be very, very good. You are just bound and determined to get on every single person's shit list, aren't you?"
"Bill, this is important. Can I come in?"
"Be my guest. Maybe I can cook up a little breakfast while you're here," said Shaw sarcastically as he closed the door behind them and relocked his deadbolts.
"Nice place," said Scott, and he meant it.
The entry hall gave way to a room dominated by oxblood leather couches with brass buttons and a big screen TV. Two walls were lined with books, and there were recessed surround sound speakers in the ceiling. The fireplace was trimmed with an ornate mantelpiece covered with pictures of the Shaw family in silver frames. In the middle of the floor was a very large and very ornate oriental rug.
"Mrs. Shaw had good taste in everything but husbands," he said,
joining Harvath at the edge of the den. Scott knew that Shaw's wife had recently divorced him, and that it had been very difficult. Scott decided to change the subject and get to the point right away.
"Bill, I think I may have some new information on the president's kidnapping."
"You? How the hell would you have any? You're not even supposed to be active. I don't know why Jameson didn't grab your creds and suspend you last night. The kidnapping of the president is no longer the purview of the Secret Service anyway. End of story."
"Can we sit down? I think you'll want to hear what I have to say."
Shaw let out an exasperated sigh and waved Harvath toward one of the couches. They took seats opposite each other, and as Shaw was rubbing the remaining sleep from his eyes, Scott began his story.
"I have reason to believe the kidnappers had some very high-placed help."
"No shit, Sherlock. We've suspected all along that there was some sort of leak."
"I'm not talking about the leak, Bill. I'm talking about guys with enough power and influence to help facilitate the introduction between the kidnappers and the source of the leak."
"You know, Harvath," said Shaw, glancing at his watch, "I have to be up for work in a few hours. I'm going to be able to fall right back asleep without hearing any fairy tales, so why don't you take yours and—"
"Bill, this is serious. I have reason to suspect that Senator Snyder and maybe Senator Rolander were involved somehow in the president's kidnapping."
Shaw moved forward on the couch.
"Snyder and maybe Rolander? What the hell are you talking about?"
"Tonight I had a meeting with a man who claims to have been Snyder's lover."
"Lover?"
"Let me finish and it will all become clear. I had the same reaction at first. Do you remember that aide on the Hill who was killed in a drive-by about a year ago?"
"Yeah, so what?"
"Well, the man I met with tonight, a Mr. Andre Martin, was involved with the aide. The aide worked for Senator Snyder and, according to Martin, was having an affair with him."
"The aide and the senator?"
"Yes. Apparently Martin got sick of the aide cheating on him and left him. The aide tried to break things off with the senator while still trying to hold on to his job and might even have tried to blackmail Snyder. Shortly thereafter, the aide was killed in the drive-by."
"Come on, Harvath. Not only is that hearsay, but it's so thin you can see through it. Sounds more like a Jackie Collins novel."
"I thought the same thing until—"
"Until what?"
"Until Martin told me that he worked his way in close to the senator and started having an affair with him himself."
"We're talking about Senator David Snyder, confirmed bachelor and renowned ladies' man?"
"We've all got our secrets, Bill. Anyway, this Martin begins an affair with the senator, convinced he was responsible for the aide's death and determined to expose him. He watches, and, more important, he listens. He listens to everything, but never lets on that he's listening. He feigns he's a heavy drinker, a sound sleeper, anything plausible that might put the senator more at ease, and create an environment in which he'll slip up. Then, he does. Recently, Martin overheard some stuff the senator thinks he shouldn't."
"Overheard stuff? What did he hear?"
"Well, he not only heard things relating to the president's kidnapping, but he also followed Snyder to Senator Rolander's house, after Snyder had received some suspicious phone calls in the middle of the night. By the way, remember that FBI agent I had the problem with in Park City?"
"The guy you creamed? What was his name?
Zushnit.
Yeah, you decked him, so?
Well, from what Martin told me, he's been calling in regular reports from Park City to Snyder, and it seems the two of them were behind framing me as the leak to CNN.
You've got to be kidding me.
Nope. From what Martin says, he heard it all loud and clear when he was listening on another extension. There's no way we can prove it right now, but if I could get my hands on that Zushnit again, I think I could encourage him to talk.
Shaw's fingers dug into the leather arm of the couch.
What about the president?
Harvath continued to fill his boss in on everything Martin had told him, and then shared something he had not told anyone about.
Do you remember how I went over to that Mormon farm where the couple was murdered?
Do I remember? Of course I do. What about it?
I found a piece of evidence there I didn't tell anybody about.
Evidence? Shaw's face was white. What kind of evidence?
Well, when I entered the house, I smelled cigarette smoke. The local law enforcement guys said they hadn't been smoking in the house, and as the couple were apparently devout Mormons, I knew they weren't smokers. It wasn't a huge leap of logic to figure out that the farm had been used as some sort of a base camp for the kidnapping.
Why do you think that?
The old couple was done by a professional. Shots to the head.
The man was, but according to the report, not the woman, said Shaw.
Yeah, I know. I think he did the man first, and the woman tried to run or something. I think he lost it, and if you'll forgive the cagneyism, filled her full of lead. The president was most likely brought to the farm via snowmobile from the scene of the kidnapping, and then transferred into whatever vehicle or vehicles they used from there. Nothing was amiss or stolen in the house, so that's why I think it was just used as a base.
So, cigarette smoke is your evidence?
No. While the killer was waiting for the rest of the kidnappers to get back from doing the job, he was smoking and probably watching TV in the family room. I think he was eating chocolate, too.
Chocolate? Jesus, Harvath. First you tell me Senator Snyder goes both ways. Then he likes to tie up and torture people who may or may not have been listening in on his phone calls and tailing him. And then your coup de grace is that one of the kidnappers may have been eating candy at a scene that is yet to be determined was connected in any way with the president's kidnapping?
The chocolate was Swiss.
So? There's lots of Swiss chocolate in the U.S., and around the world for that matter. I hate to be the one to burst your bubble, but after yodeling and watches, it's probably one of the biggest things the Swiss are known for.
I disagree.
I don't think this chocolate is an export product, at least not for the States. It had German writing on it.
So? Maybe someone brought it back from a trip to Germany as a gift for the old couple.
But the couple was Mormon. And caffeine is another thing that is forbidden by their religion.
Listen, you're in enough trouble as it is. Tell me you didn't take anything from the crime scene. You left that chocolate right where you found it, right?
Harvath couldn't tell if Shaw was trying to lead him toward the answer he wanted to hear, or if he really wanted the truth. Either way, something told Scott that he should not admit to having removed the chocolate from the crime scene.
No, I left it there.
Good. Then it's the FBI's problem, and they can decide whether it's relevant or not when they find it. I think, though, that you're making a mountain out of a molehill. You're very stressed out. I haven't had a chance to read your fitness report. Did you see Dr. Helzebeck?
Yes.
And?
And nothing. She says I'm fine. Says my head might feel scrambled for a few more days, but that's pretty much it.
Are you taking any medications?
Only Tylenol. I haven't been able to shake this headache.
Shaw was quiet for a few moments while he thought. His fingertips were pressed together in an arch in front of his nose, with his thumbs supporting his chin. Scott could hear the ticking of a grandfather clock in the hall. Finally, Shaw broke the silence.
All right. I think there's enough here to bring Andre Martin into protective custody while we look into this. Where is he?
He's with Natalie Sperando at the Radisson Old Town in Alexandria.
Sperando?
She's the one who introduced Martin to me. He was a very close friend of her brother's.
How much does she know?
Pretty much everything Martin does.
Okay, so they're both at the Radisson. Is that the one on Fairfax at Montgomery?
Yes, about 15 minutes down from the metro.
I know it. Okay, we'll send a car to pick them up and bring them in. We have a safe house not too far from there that we can use. Were you able to ascertain whether they had talked to anyone else about this?
No, they assured me that they hadn't. I stressed to them that anyone that they might have even hinted about this to could be in danger, and they said they were the only ones.
Good. That makes our job a lot easier. Now, I can't promise you that this is going to help your case. At best, it's all circumstantial, and it's Andre Martin's word against Senator Snyder's. I think he was smart to kick that piece of rope under the dryer. Forensics can place him in Snyder's house and in the basement. That kid was thinking. As far as you're concerned, I'm going to do this quietly. You are in enough trouble as it is, and if this turns out to be a load of BS, you don't need any more problems. I'm going to ask you this once, and I want you to answer me honestly. Have you spoken with anyone other than Martin and Sperando about this?
No.
Are you sure that no one overheard you talking at the bar?
As sure as I can be.
Okay. Good. Now, is there anything else you want to tell me about what happened in Park City? If you've got anything, now is the time to get it out.
Harvath thought for a moment.
No, you know the full story.
Do you have any idea who or what this stargazer might be?
None at all.
For all we know, said Shaw, with all your astronomy gear, it could be you.
Me? What the hell do you—
God, calm down, Harvath. I was just pulling your chain. Cripes, you're irritable.
I'm sorry, Bill. I'm just a little on edge.
Yeah, I can see that.
So, what's our next move?
Okay, I'll get my laptop from the den for you and put a pot of coffee on. I want a full report, including any of the details you might have accidentally forgotten concerning Park City. If I'm going to go to bat for you, I can't have any surprises. I want all of it while it's fresh in your mind. While you're working on that, I'll get started on bringing Martin and Sperando in. Was there an established code for calling so they would know it was you?
I had a register under the name Cashman.
Fine. I'll whip up some coffee and get the laptop. In the meantime, you can use the phone on the end of the table there to call them.
Harvath did as he was told. He explained to Natalie that either he or Shaw would be calling back shortly with details on the pickup. He told her that they would be taken to a nearby safe house, and Andre placed in protective custody, pending a preliminary investigation. She had done the right thing calling him, and she should be proud. They were going to be all right. 10 minutes later, Shaw appeared with a mug of coffee and his laptop. As Scott began typing his report, Shaw headed for his den. Closing the doors behind him, he crossed the distance to the phone in 3 fast strides. He picked it up and dialed the number in McLean from memory.
38.
Marcia? Asked Shaw, after a sleepy voice answered the number he had dialed.
You've got the wrong number, said the voice, and the call was disconnected.
Shaw sat patiently and waited behind the thick locked doors of his study. On a bank of monitors next to his desk, he watched an image of Agent Harvath, diligently typing his report. The small hidden camera had him perfectly in frame. 3 minutes later, Shaw's private line rang, and he depressed the button to activate the scrambler hidden within the desk.
It's an odd time for a phone call, said Shaw.
This is when the rates are the lowest, though, answered the voice.
Each of the party's authentication codes completed, the conversation could now begin. They spoke freely, knowing that the lines were secure and the scramblers would prevent anyone from eavesdropping.
You'd better have something good, Shaw, to call me this late at night. My wife and I were sound asleep.
I do, Senator.
Well, get on with it.
Senator Rolander, it seems that your colleague, Senator Snyder, has been less than discreet.
Less than discreet? Speak English, man. What do you mean?
I mean Snyder allowed someone to overhear some of his more sensitive conversations.
This admission made Rolander very nervous. He gripped the handset of the telephone tighter.
What kind of conversations?
The worst kind. The kind that could send us all away for a very long time,
if not get us executed for treason. First of all, I don't care how secure these lines are. I want you to watch your language and choose your words very carefully. Do you understand me?
Yes, sir.
Good. Now run down what it is you're talking about and give me all the details. 5 minutes later, Shaw's story was complete. He had left out some of the details, but none of the important ones. Senator Rolander had the picture.
That hedonistic son of a bitch, swore Rolander. To tell you the truth, it doesn't matter who he was sleeping with. This still could have happened.
I agree.
But what does matter is that Snyder got sloppy, and now we'll have to clean up his mess. Where is Agent Harbath right now?
In my TV room.
He's in your house? And you're on the phone with me? What kind of an idiot are you?
Relax, Senator. He's on candid camera. I'm watching him on a closed-circuit monitor right now. He hasn't budged in the last 10 minutes, and he can't hear us.
What's he doing?
I have him writing up a full report.
That report can never see daylight, you understand?
Of course. There's nothing to worry about,
said Shaw, as he eyeballed a set of books across the room that hid his wall safe. The report would never get out, unless he needed it to. For now, it would stay in his safe and be a nice insurance policy. Once Harbath finished it and they printed it out, Shaw would read it over, have Harbath sign it, and it would go right into the safe.
As soon as he's done, I'll destroy it. We don't need any loose ends that could cause us trouble, do we, Senator?
Rolander didn't like the man's tone, but he let it go. No, we don't. How long do you think it will take him to complete the report?
A couple of hours, based on everything I've asked for.
Good. The last thing we want is for him to be out running around loose.
I agree. That's why I've kept him here. Do you have any idea how lucky we are that he came to me? Asked Shaw.
Extremely. You're sure neither he nor this Martin nor Natalie Sperando has spoken with anyone else?
I'm pretty certain.
Good. I want you to keep him there until I call you back. Under no circumstances is he to leave. Is that understood?
Yes, sir.
Rolander took down the address of the Radisson in Alexandria and hung up. After dialing several different numbers, Rolander finally tracked down Senator Snyder on his cell phone.
Russell, I'd love to talk right now, but I'm extremely busy, said Snyder.
Snyder could be busy with only one thing, looking for Andre Martin.
Lost something, have you? Asked Rolander.
Maybe.
Listen, David. Quit fucking around. I need to talk to you, and I don't want to do it while you're on a cell phone.
It's digital, and there's no one here but us mices, so go ahead.
Senator Rolander didn't know what nobody here but us mices meant, but he assumed Snyder was referring to some of the contract men he sometimes hired for illegal operations.
Rolander continued,
You wouldn't be hoping, as the commercial says, to bring a little Andre home for the holidays, would you?
Snyder remained silent. He was stunned.
Are you still there? Asked Rolander.
Yeah, I'm here.
How did you know?
To quote an old friend, how I know is not as important as what I know. You fucked up big time. Remember how keen I was on the CYA factor? Well, my ass, who am I kidding? All of our asses are out in the wind right now, and it's your fault. Digital or not, I want to have this conversation over some eggs, preferably scrambled, so get back to your place and call me.
Sorry, Russell. I still have that little lost dog, or should I say bitch, I need to find. I'll have to call you when I get around to it.
Listen, you stupid bastard. I know where he is and will happily tell you, but arrangements need to be made quickly. Get home and call me back.
Rolander hung up the phone, severing the connection. Turning to his driver, Snyder said, Take me back to the townhouse. We may have caught a break.
39. The hulking black Chevy Suburban with its darkened windows crept quietly up Washington Street through Alexandria's old town. This late at night, there wasn't much traffic. Even with the windows rolled up, the scent of the nearby Potomac filled the inside of the vehicle. At Pendleton Street, and a sign for Orinoco Bay Park, the driver turned right. 3 blocks later was Royal Street, and then Fairfax. The vehicle turned left and crept northward. The glowing sign of the Radisson was soon visible. When the Suburban came parallel with the main entrance, it turned in. The driver parked directly in front of the hotel's main doors and left the engine running. At this hour, only a skeleton crew was on duty. An attractive Filipino woman whose name tag read Anna looked up from her paperwork and smiled as the man approached the front desk.
"Good evening. May I help you, sir?"
asked Anna in her accented English.
"Yes, you can," said the man, removing a black wallet from inside his suit coat pocket and showing her his credentials. "My name is Agent Scott Harvath, Secret Service. I'm here to pick up a Mr. and Mrs.—"
The man pulled a notepad from his other pocket, flipped a couple of pages, and pretended to come to the name.
Mr. and Mrs. Cashman. I believe you have them registered here?"
The desk clerk glanced over the man's shoulder and saw the blacked-out Suburban parked in front. It looked very official, just like the one she had seen so many times on TV. She looked back at the handsome man standing in front of her and thought that he must have had the bluest eyes she had ever seen. She tore her eyes away from his and tapped some keys on her computer.
"Yes, sir. They are registered guests of the hotel."
"Can you please tell me what room they are in?" asked the man.
"Is there a problem? Normally we are not supposed to give out that information," said Anna.
"I understand, and it is a very appropriate policy. This is a matter of national security, though. As I told you, my name is Agent Scott Harvath, and I am with the Secret Service. I have been instructed to pick up the Cashmans."
"Surely," the man said, leaning in and pretending to read the clerk's name tag for the first time.
"Anna, you wouldn't want to interfere with a matter of national security."
Concerned, she answered,
"No, sir, of course I wouldn't. The staff has been instructed to always assist the police and other law enforcement should they ever come to the hotel. I will need to note this in my nightly report, though."
"I understand. That's no problem. Now, would you please tell me what room they're in?"
"Let's see," she said, glancing down. "Room 257. It appears as if they paid for the room in advance. Will they be checking out?"
"Yes," said the man. "I'm going to go up and help them with their bags. Would you please call their room and let them know that Secret Service Agent Scott Harvath is on his way up?"
"Yes, I will."
"Thank you," said the man, as he crossed the lobby toward the elevators.
2 minutes later, he knocked upon the door numbered 257.
"Who is it?"
came a female voice from inside.
"Secret Service, ma'am. I'm here to transport you and Mr. Martin."
The door did not open.
"The desk clerk said that Agent Harvath was here," said Natalie.
"She must have gotten confused. I asked her to call up to your room and tell you that a Secret Service agent sent by Agent Harvath was here to pick you up."
After a few moments of silence, the chain slid back and the door opened. Both Natalie and Andre had their jackets on, ready to go. They followed the man into the elevator and down to the lobby. He had instructed them that time was of the essence and that they must move quickly. As they reached the front desk, he placed their 2 key cards on it and kept moving.
"Thank you for staying at the Radisson Old Town. We hope to see you again," said the desk clerk, as the trio exited the front door.
The man opened the side door of the Suburban. Natalie was relieved to see an agent sitting on the rear bench seat holding a shotgun. As they all climbed in and the man shut the door behind them, the vehicle, even though it was under the Radisson's brightly lit canopy, quickly darkened due to the blacked-out windows. Another man, whom Natalie figured to be an additional agent, sat in the front passenger seat. They were taking this very seriously. That was good. She and Andre could finally relax. The Suburban swung out of the driveway and headed back south toward the Capitol Beltway. They were on their way. For the first time since his ordeal began, Andre breathed a sigh of relief.
"I cannot tell you how glad I am to see you guys."
"Oh, I'm sure. But not half as glad as we are to see you," said the man in the front seat. The reassuring voice put Natalie further at ease until she saw the horrified look on Andre's face. He was completely still. Natalie couldn't understand why his demeanor had so suddenly changed until the passenger turned around to look at them. The man in the front seat spoke.